You can avoid these landmines.
It's a buy versus build conversation.
What's the root cause of that mistake?
Very moved by your story.
Dive all in on the next chapter of your life.
Welcome to The Boutique with Collective 54, a podcast for founders and leaders of boutique professional services firms. Our goal with this show is to help you grow, scale, and exit your firm bigger and faster. I'm Sean McGinnis, Collective 54 Advisory Board Member and your host. On this episode, I will make the case that to scale your firm requires capital and that not all capital is the same. I'll try to prove this theory by interviewing Josh Miramant, founder and CEO at Blue Orange Digital. Blue Orange is a data science and machine learning consulting and development firm. They build modern data warehousing to support machine learning and AI. Blue Orange helps companies integrate these insights to drive data-driven decisions and the decision-making. You can find Josh at blueorange.digital. Josh, great to be with you. Welcome.
Thanks, Sean. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hopefully I did justice to that explanation of all the great things you're doing.
For how many buzzwords in our space, you couldn't have nailed it better, Sean. Good work.
So, Josh, let's start with an overview. So, why do firms need capital when trying to scale is the big question. Scaling usually means entering new markets, launching new service lines, adding more headcount, and many other strategic initiatives. These things all take money. So can you briefly share with the audience an example of how you raise capital to scale your firm or how you think about raising capital to scale firms?
Sure. Yeah. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and just a little background. I've actually started two venture-backed companies prior. So I actually came out of, you know, SaaS product and then kind of large equity raise type background. And this is my first professional services firm, and it's quite a different beast in many great ways, with like high profit generating types of business initiatives that you can use things like cash flow to reinvest in growth, all the way over to you know the challenging pieces that they're very cash hungry business models. To be honest, they take a lot of efforts like investing into resourcing of staffing and having, you know, carrying a bench and resource allocation and all these things that are very quite expensive and have to be, you know, very well forecasted when you're thinking about financial backing. So we've taken a pretty holistic approach to our financial backing for this, and, you know, not unique. I've actually, luckily enough, I've sold my last company. And so I was able to fortunately do some self-investing, but we quickly wanted to move to more institutional as we've gone along. So I opened up at the start with friends and family debt round, and mostly lived in debt for our organization. And in the early days, I was able to personally back just under about $500,000 of total kind of personally backed notes through successive order of kind of like friends and family to more institutionals at different tiers of raise. And then we've even looked at some other side of we have had discussions with investment banks and private equity firms about potential acquisitions. So we've or investments based on equity side, and that starts to move in that, you know, moving the term sheets around equity raise and even some interesting partnership model equity raises that we're even currently talking about. So it's a pretty interesting range of options that we've explored in total so far.
You know, I love that. And your experience is so unique because you've come to share with our listeners from the perspective of having, you know, started two venture-backed more tech firms. This is your first professional services firm. So you bring all of the knowledge there, and then, you know, you're in this sort of reinvention mode, and yet you're still leveraging these unique sources of finance. So this is going to be great for our listeners to get your insight. So, Josh, what I thought I'd do is, you know, at the top of the show, I suggested that not all capital is the same. And these days, and I don't know if you're finding this, but certainly I am, that capital is abundant in the market. And there are very, very many different kinds. So I'd like to get your thoughts on what we call a do-it-yourself approach. I'll illustrate three types of capital. And yes, I know there are more. So if you want to throw out some others that you've got personal experience in, that would be great too. So the first one I'd like your input on is free cash flow from operations. So this comes from increasing revenue, driving down costs, using the spread between those to scale, and scaling with free cash flow preserves owners' equity, does not add a debt service burden to the P&L. What are your thoughts on this, Josh?
This is one of the absolute magic parts about professional services agencies is that you're able to have a lot of control and be a lot, it puts you in an interesting position. But I love, and Cassius King, that's the name of professional services agency. I mean, you summarized the absolute beautiful part about cash flow, which is equity, you know, owner equity, and not having to dilute too early in your growth phase. And my philosophy on when I entered into professional services, my philosophy was that the, you know, our profit, our EBITDA would be the measure of our success. And that's controlled, but it would show how successful we were in the market. And as yes. I think that was something that allowed us to think about our growth planning based on our cash flow. I think that was truly as we got and developed more client base and shown more market adoption and understood how to sell this better, we were able to expand our growth. And I think that was a nice guardrailed control mechanism. And once we got our sea, you know, our sea legs under us, and you know, we're going to peak over 10 million top line this year, we will be able to start thinking about taking on more debt burden, or now you're in this and other options that we'll talk about in a bit. But that growth, that controlled growth, to getting that point with a lot of capital reinvestment was incredibly helpful. It allowed both for planning, aka not growing too quickly, having some of the scale constraints, but also being very thoughtful with where you're making that capital investment. One thing I would say that we've learned late, and it became a major challenge for us in the early days, because our monthly invoicings were pretty modest, and so we can afford to cover, and you know, a lot of how we're doing, we have billing in arrears, and so you'd have your cash flow was usually met like a 60-day window. We'd do a month of work, we would bill and have a net 30 payments, and you know, I've heard a lot of different firms and colleagues do it differently, but that was a 60-day cycle if everyone pays on time at end of billing.
Yes.
We have started moving heavily into reducing down that cash flow cycle, getting into lower net 15 or even upfront billing or upfront invoicing on net 30. So you're really even reducing down to 30 days, and quite candidly, with very little pushback. And from a cash flow perspective, I would say we shipped about 80% of our current clients, which we have a pretty long client lifecycle, and almost every new one onto that with very little exclusion. And that movement to that shorter revenue cycle has actually massively increased the amount of cash flow we've had, which amazes us to even grow quicker and have to take on less either interest or equity release or dilution release types of options. So it's I think controlling your cash, it's obviously just goal to get cash in and spend it and know how to think about that layer and then have planning. But I would say even more thoughtful ways of having that discussion with our clients up front. We're pretty candid, like, you know, we're a small boutique and we want to keep cash flow so we can invest in your team and make sure we have good management. And they're right alongside with supporting us on tighter cash flow cycles. So love cash flow, obviously like to keep and preserve equity. So at the end of the day, that's the cheapest money you're going to get out there.
You know, I love what you've said. And everything you've said, you know, I totally agree with. One of the interesting things you said, and I don't want this to be lost on our listeners, is that you were surprised at the ability to get paid upfront or get a shorter payment cycle on your AR. That is fantastic. And I think a lot of owners of boutique firms don't have the courage or they fear asking for that. So give me a little bit more on that as to how you went about it, because I think our listeners, if all they do is get from this, the shortening of the AR or getting prepayments upfront, that will leapfrog their ability to use free cash flow for other things.
Yeah, and this is easily the most important thing that's happened. We're really growing. We're on scale to double this year. It's like our growth whip is big. And so every dime counts right now. For us, we're doing multiple types of financing plus because we're hiring like crazy and we have larger amounts of resource allocation, like unallocated resource between projects. So all the things you expect with the type of management of our company. But the thing that's amazing was when we had these conversations, first off, understanding what's right for your business. How is it logical for your clients to pay you appropriately? You want to make sure you consider, but not every conversation was about what risk was the company taking for giving us money. And yes. I think that was important to have that conversation. So yes. For our business, we actually had and how we message it was thinking about how they would consider it. So saying, you know, hey, we're going to invoice you up front. We're going to keep you net 30 though. So we'll be completing all of the work that we're offering this revenue for. And so really it's not payment up front, it's invoicing up front, and you just align the payment to work the most recently completed. And everybody loved that partnership.
It's brilliant.
If we're asking for payment up front, accounting teams freak out. They're like, oh, we don't want to put risk of giving you our cash and not sure how the work would be done. None of that risk was there. It's like, hey, if we're doing such a terrible job in delivery, your cash is still sitting in the bank and you have all the leverage. And you know, we stand by our great work. So there is zero risk here. And you're just helping us with keeping control in our cycle. So the narrative, thinking about what our clients were worried about, completely changed our messaging. And so the second thing that once we had, when there was any pushback, and we did have a couple clients, you know, very friendly say, oh, we don't like to, it's kind of like a retainer cycle or deposit. We never talked about that.
Right.
We can then say, hey, let's get rid of this. That's no problem. But could you help us out instead of a net 30, which is pretty industry standard, let's do a net 15 or net 10. And they're like, oh, of course, that's no problem. So now we're in this discussion where we just decreased our AR by 25%.
25 days, yeah, exactly.
Started that conversation instead of just being like, oh, it's 60 and hopefully they pay on time. And now I'm scrambling cash 3 payroll cycles later. And so it's just having that conversation that you're thinking about the messaging, you're bringing it out to clients the way that say de-risks their position. And ultimately, you know, deliver good work and they have no problem making payments close to cycles. That's the kind of the cardinal rule here.
It's so smart and it's so good. And you're both at the same time, what you're doing is you're educating your team to operate on that basis and you're educating your client. You know, so it's a really good and if it's positioned, as you've said, and messaged well, it's a win-win for both. And I know that's a trite statement, but thank you for sharing that because underneath your original comments were these two very specific tactics, which if a boutique firm can do that, it's going to be golden. So let's get to the number two. So the second aspect is debt. So debt typically would come from a bank. It would come from a private lender. It may not be cheap, but it is reasonable as lenders charge modest rates on loans. And it's also readily available in the 2 to 3 times EBITDA range is what we would typically see. What's your opinion on debt?
Yeah, so I love debt personally. I always like to just start with my investment banker that I work with often. I loved how he framed this. And there's this spectrum of a professional service founder. That's the greed fear spectrum. And I love how he thinks about this. On the greed side, you're like, you don't want to give up your equity. This is the thing you're building. That's the compounding value. And candidly, particularly with when you're investing cash flow or investing your earning back into the business, these are cash hungry machines that take a lot of it. And it's hard, you know, your investment can be tied up pretty heavily in the ownership of a firm. That's always a concern of an owner of not being too tied into a single, you know, having some diversity in portfolio, not just a company.
Yes.
And so I think it's an interesting on the greed side, you want to keep that compounding engine because you can take out your salary and whatever disbursements you're going to take that you choose, you know, post-EBITDA. But the angle there is just coming down to the fear side is not making payroll. It's not being able to hire. It's not being able to grow quick enough. And I think that's always this dichotomy that exists that I always take this metric on. Debt is this wonderful piece that's kind of stepping partially into the equity get out, which I think we'll get a chance to talk about my thoughts there in a minute.
Yes.
Debt is a wonderful play. I think that there's a couple things to consider. What you're spending it on is crucial. So I think it's always focusing on, you know, it's like, I think debt should be considered on OPEX experience, never CAPEX. I think that's a little bit, and that's my rules. There's other thoughts there, but like on areas that you can service and keep revenue coming when you're looking at that.
Yeah.
I think there's angles of debt being not, as you made notes, 2 to 3 EBITDA. I think that's a reasonable starting point depending on personal liquidity or other factors that you have for backup. But I also think taking on debt with consideration of a repayment calendar, like based on your projections and knowing what worst case is and best case is based
precisely
on real data and keeping it modest until you have a pretty confident projection into your repayment calendar. And then truly just, I think that you're right, like capital is pretty cheap right now. In general, it's been our experience. We have some pretty, really very favorable interest rates, but very tangibly looking how much that money's costing you.
Yes.
And I think that's a big piece of how much you are losing out on future revenue. And is it smarter to keep cash flow and grow slower, or is it smarter to take that, capture that revenue and turn it into more compatibility? And I think that at the right point, that is absolutely something you should do. We raised a friends and family around. I took out a line of credit from just a traditional, you know, institutional bank. A Chase is our banking partner, and they had a $250,000 line of credit, which was really friendly to, you know, use.
Fabulous.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful debt option there, because it's only, you know, only paying when you're using it, which is lovely. And it's right at your fingertips. And then we've gone and just closed another $400,000 debt financing round, which is pretty good for our books right now, on a more traditional note, and still pretty favorable interest rates. And the loan, the interest on it is pretty modest to our EBITDA. So it's a very, you know, nice opportunity for us to have, you know, feel very comfortable on our AR cycle, and tied with, you know, upfront billing in that direction, a really strong cash flow position, even with this large growth factor, which is really nice to see.
And I would assume that you've also got some good forward visibility on contracting that's coming forward, because that helps exactly. You manage your greed fear component that you just spoke to, right?
Couldn't be more apt there. And I think honestly, the amount I would be sensitive to take out as much debt as I have, unless we had, you know, contracts in place. You know, we have even things that I was sensitive to on not taking extending my debt financing options until we had a diverse set of contracts that were pretty far. I don't want just one big client or a couple, you know, a few small ones that are like kind of tail end cycle with low visibility. We could lose a good chunk of our, you know, any individual client have no impact on our financial stability. That took a while to build, for sure. And I think that was the piece where your point of forecasting and de-risking the loan actually was less about being able to service, you know, a few thousand dollars a month in interest, which is not, you know, and the percentages are tiny, but it's actually coupled with a repayment schedule and projections against where that, you know, with their contracts, we can stick to that calendar either way. It just means other future growth constraints, but still better market opportunity with the clients we took on.
You know, brilliant. And you've also hit on a couple of additional key things that, like client quality, so ability of the client to pay, which is critical, diversification of your client group, so you're not anchored, you don't have all your eggs in one basket, and you know, you've got your backlog and the quality of your contracting. So fantastic. I mean, this is exactly what we want listeners to really get a handle on, because when using a debt instrument, all those factors should be in place, and you need to be able to feel comfortable, go to sleep at night, you know, that you're not going to wake up one morning and not be able to service the debt, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just a note too, I think that in the early days, I've got kind of some questions later on about this, but I was fortunate enough to have some pretty decent sized loans, personal backing. And I think that's a thing.
Yes.
I'm lucky. And
yes.
That's kind of my thing. But it is also very exciting when we can move beyond me not being having the personal back loans. That was great money. And that was where it certainly takes a lot more to build a business to that point. But I do think that was a healthy risk appetite that I was willing to, at smaller scale, to then show, you know, repeated receivables and show a consistent client base. But that transition from, you know, I would certainly say if debt is where you're looking to go as you're building a company up to, you know, 100 employees, and you know, to mention our top line, but in that size, as we're building up, I certainly couldn't get meaningful amounts of money or large enough amounts of money just on the business alone until we got a little bigger. And then it became something where that was because of the combination of cash flow, and it's just being not as much of covering the percentage of our, our MMR, then it was interesting how that became a really good solution on the company's books.
I love that. And you know, it works, right? In the early stages, you take the personal guarantee. In the midlife style, you don't need to do it. You know, there's an appropriate time to take on personal risk, and there's a time, as you've just illustrated, where the company can take on that risk on the balance sheet. So let's flip to the third aspect, which is equity partners. So this is when an investor puts cash in exchange for a piece of the business, and then the owner's stake is diluted as a result. What do you think about equity for a boutique professional services firm?
Yeah, so I get a little more sensitive when it comes to equity with a company like a professional services firm. And not, I'm first off, as I mentioned in my background, I think equity raises are really important. And I think it's just when and what you're looking to build your firm.
Yes.
I think the two questions that you need to understand here. So I, at the core of what we're, let me just share my thinking around that. So unlike a SaaS product where you just think high multipliers, I call it high multiples and valuation are the expectation. If you are successful on your strategy, you're, you know, 10, 50, whatever X you're thinking
about,
you know, you're going to get your projection on a professional services, depending on a little variability of your space and your, and what, how much tech or how much automation is inside of the way that you do what you're doing is, or what the product is underside what you're building. You know, you're looking at a 2.5 to 4.5 range multiplier. Those are rough numbers and going to be different for every one of your listeners here. But that's kind of where our sector fell. We're cutting edge buzzword tech stuff. So we're probably a little bit more depending on, but depending on how strong your sales team and all these factors, you know, we got to not get into the details.
Yes.
So it's interesting to think about when you look at those multiples, what are you looking to build? Like if you're really looking to scale a business, you need a lot more money. You need to invest in bigger sales organizations. But that comes with, once you make to the next stage, like I always look at our objective and goals as a company is to move into that 25 to 30 million top line revenue company as we scale out. And I look at that as what my investment team talks about as the platform layer of a professional services agency. That's their terms. I like it.
Yeah, I think
it's that first, if you're looking to scale, it's like when you become a platform that things like taking on, you know, an equity raise and acquiring other companies become an option. You can actually absorb into you if you as an option that would be not, I mean, typically a lot of this is selling into other firms, which I've actually done some other interesting areas around equity, partnership equity, which is an interesting area that we've been talking about with a few of our partners lately,
yes,
which is very compelling because it actually reduces some of the equity dilution, or sorry, my owner dilution along with the, while still getting pretty good terms on capital. But the biggest factor is you are trading control. And it's usually in a very good way if you get a good partner and you take on a good relationship with a firm, because that's expertise,
precisely,
that's exposure, all the things that come with a higher, you know, higher opportunities of the in addition to the cash. So lots of good, but that control factor is important when you start thinking about what you're looking to execute. So I think that equity, when a founder, and how I feel about it, when a founder feels really confident in their business model and can sell it well, and they should know how much equity they're going to give up for capital.
Like exactly.
We did a full to term sheet, you know, equity raise, and I didn't feel comfortable with the dilution amount at the time. And they're generous terms, and I think appropriately valued our company, but it just, the dilution was more of a control consideration on one side. And candidly, if it was done now, I think it might be below a margin where my control factor would be given up. So it's a little bit sort of the founder's goal. Like we're looking to scale quite large and like cleaving off 50% of our equity right now, and sort of when we did our raise,
yes,
that'd be too much dilution down the road. But it's now when you get a little bigger, have more receivables, or have, you know, valued more competition or have more staff, the value of the company starts giving you competitive options. So it's a little individual, but I love equity. I just think the time and the goals are crucial to be considered.
I love that. So the time and the goals, crucial for consideration. This is excellent, Josh, really. So I can't think of a more important high-stakes strategic decision for our listeners to get right. As we've gone through these three, there are others. So this takes us to the end of this episode. And by the way, we're going to have plenty of opportunities to discuss this, particularly in Collective 54 going forward. So this has been extraordinarily valuable. As is customary, we end each show with a tool. We do so because this allows a listener to apply the lessons to his or her firm. Our preferred tool is a checklist. Our style of checklist is a yes-no questionnaire. We aim to keep it simple by asking only 10 questions. So in this instance, if you answer yes to 8 or more of these questions, all 3 of these capital sources are available to you. If you answer no to questions 1 to 3, don't pursue funding scale with free cash flow. If you answer no to 4 to 9, don't rely on debt. And if you answer no to question 10, don't take on an equity partner. Josh has graciously agreed to be our peer example today. So Josh, I'll just ask you these 10 questions, give a simple yes, no, and here we go. So, number 1, are you generating enough free cash flow to fund scale?
Yes.
Number 2, do you know where to deploy this extra free cash flow?
Oh, yes.
I love it. Number 3, are you willing to go without today for scale tomorrow?
Yes.
Number 4, have you been in business for at least 5 years?
Yes, we have.
Number 5, are you generating stable EBITDA every year?
Well, yes, and COVID, but yes.
Okay. Oh, that's good. I mean, that's real, right? You're being honest.
It's exciting years. But
exciting
yeah.
years. Number six, would 2 to 3 times EBITDA be enough to fund scaling your firm?
Yes.
Yeah. Number seven, can your P&L handle the debt service burden of a loan?
Yes.
Number eight, are you willing to personally guarantee a loan?
Yes.
Yeah, you've done it.
Done it. I've been in the trenches on that one.
Absolutely. Number nine, do you have enough personal assets to secure the loan if open to a guarantee?
Yes.
And number 10, are you willing to dilute your ownership take for the right equity partner?
Yes.
Outstanding. So in summary, it takes money to make money. Scaling a boutique takes money. There are different funding sources, each with their own pros and cons. All can work well. Which is best for you is highly situational. And Josh, you've said that. So take your time, listeners, to consider this very important strategic decision. Josh, a huge thank you today for sharing all of the real life examples. I love your enthusiasm. I love the fact that you're in Manhattan. I could hear the traffic, which we haven't heard a lot in the last 6 months. It's brilliant. It makes me feel as if we're in the real world. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed this show and want to learn more, pick up a copy of the book, The Boutique, How to Start, Scale, and Sell a Professional Services Firm, written by Collective 54 founder, Greg Alexander. And for more expert support, check out Collective 54, the first expert community for founders and leaders of boutique professional services firms. Collective 54 will help you grow, scale, and exit your firm bigger and faster. Go to collective54.com to learn more. Thank you for listening.